Ben Helfgott, Reel 4.
It seemed to me that I have been working for many hours. I really didn't know what time it was. As I said, I could hardly keep my eyes open. And then one of them said to me, "Go and have a look, what is the time?" Well, I accepted this with alacrity and with relief, because all I want to do is just to get up, even to just walk away. So I took my time to go to the place where they had a big clock, and I looked at the time, and I nearly passed out, because only hardly an hour passed by, and to me it seemed like I was almost ready to go home. Well, I really felt very dejected, very low, and very subdued. I returned, and as I sat down on the concrete, so quickly I jumped up, because whilst I was away, they thought they were going to play a joke on me. They poured the hot glass on the concrete. And concrete, as you know, heats very quickly. And they heated up that concrete. And of course, the fact that I took my time longer played into their hands. I came back and they told me off why I took such a long time. But at the same time, they were absolutely delighted about it. Because when I sat down, I jumped up very quickly. And as I jumped up, they again played football with me. They were hitting my head. Kicked me, "Sit down." So I sat down. I couldn't sit, so I got up. So on the one hand, I was getting my behind burned. On the other hand, I was getting my head kicked. Well, to them it was hilarious. They were laughing and joking. Another great success. They managed to make a 12-year-old boy look ridiculous. Okay? I don't know how I survived, but by the time the morning came, I was completely and utterly shattered, and I was completely exhausted. Came home, my mother, of course, immediately noticed there was something wrong and said, "What's the matter?" And I told her. She said, I told you you're not going to go to work, and you see you didn't listen to me, I told you to go to sleep. Anyway, she put me to sleep right away, and I slept the whole day. I didn't wake up till about an hour or so before I was going to, go back to work. My father was back home at the time, and he said to me, "You're not going back to work. I will see to it, because once you are enlisted, you had to go, because otherwise you could be punished." But my father said to me, "Don't worry, I'll arrange it." I said to my father, "No, I'm going to see it through." But I went to work. I started getting used to it. About 2 or 3 days later, one of the the Poles used to work very closely with one or two Jewish people who used to tell them who can afford to pay the money. And one of them came to me and said, "Look, I can fix it up for you that you don't have to work with these people and you don't have to work so hard. But it's going to cost you. Talk to your father and let me know about it." I came home, I told my father. My father said, "Fine, that's good." And I arranged for my father to meet the foreman, the Polish foreman. Father met the foreman and agreed to pay him a certain amount of money for me, and from that moment on, my life at work improved. First of all, he took me away from that man, and then I used to be working as reserve. So there were times when I really didn't have to do very much. Of course, it made life a lot easier. But it was extremely boring. Because I always had to hide, I was always frightened in case somebody would catch me and so on. So there was no real blessing, because whichever way it was, I was always frightened. You see, on the one hand, I took great chances. But the fact that I was frightened never put me off from taking these chances. I'm not trying to present myself as a hero, because I always remember being frightened. But in spite of it, I would never run away from anything. And I never have, nor have I ever done it in normal life. I always wanted to face everything, and this was exactly the same in my childhood, during my experiences in the camps as well. That, as I said, it does not mean that I did it because of bravado or anything. It was simply that I had to see it through, in spite of things I was fine. Now, within 1 month, I managed to contract dysentery. It happened also during the night shift, because we had to we changed round, but so it was every third week I was working on night shift. But used to be very hot, and because it was hot, I was drinking enormous quantities of water, and I must have eaten some fruit or something, and that brought about dysentery. Well, it was a dysentery of a very acute kind. And I had to be taken to hospital. And for a few days, it was really touch and go.
There a hospital in the ghetto
area? There was a ghetto, yes. It was a ghetto. There, you see, because you got to remember, there was this typhoid epidemic. There were hospital. It was a Jewish hospital. It was the same hospital before the war. There was a Jewish hospital. I recovered. But my... stomach was still not in order, and I have a feeling that it has left me with a very weak stomach ever since, because for a very long time I used to pass blood, and of course I had to be very careful what food I was going to eat. It wasn't easy to get the right kind of food. I mean, rice, for instance, was at a premium. And my father went to the nth degree to get it for me, and eventually managed to get some. For a long time, had to be very careful, because I simply was suffering from the after effects of dysentery. But these were very trying days, very worrying days, because we were getting now information coming from all quarters that the neighboring towns, neighboring cities are being emptied and people are being deported. And there were rumors coming that next day, we are going to be, we will be the next ones to go. So eventually, it came on the 14th of October. Now, it also so happens, everything happens to me, seems to be on the night shift with that glass factory. I happened to be working at that time also on the night shift. And we were told for about 2 or 3 days that it's already started, but it didn't start. Then I went to work. The one evening I went to work, I said cheerio to my mother, hoping that, of course, I'll see you in the morning. My father was at that stage outside the ghetto. And in the morning, when I finished work, we all went out of the factory, we counted up, and I said, oh, thank God that everything is fine. And we were just about to march off when we were told, stop, you can't go back to the ghetto. The ghetto is closed. And things are happening. So there I was, in the glass factory. They allocated a stable, what used to be a stable. They took us the horses and they put us in the stable. We were living on a straw, on the floor. In one large stable, there were about 40, 50 people. One person next to another, one on top of another. This was October, it was already getting cold. Now, I was rather frightened, you see, because I left my mother by herself, together with my aunt. My father was not at home. It was already after curfew hours. At that stage, my youngest sister was with Polish people in a village, and the older sister, not my oldest, but the second sister, she was in another town with Poles as well, together with my cousin. So I knew that these two are somewhere. I didn't know exactly the places, but I knew that they were given away to into hiding. But I was terribly worried because of what has happened. And in the afternoon, people started coming into the glass factory. And there were those who were working in the glass factory who were caught in the ghetto still. And they told us the story, what's happened, that the deportation started, killing already started as well, and that the people are being deported and sent away to wherever it is. Fortunately, amongst the people who came was a man who lived in the same building where we did. And I asked him whether he's seen my mother. And he said, no, I haven't seen her. I said, am I sure? And he said, no, she definitely wasn't amongst, because they ordered, you see, they were doing it very orderly. It was very well organized. Street, first for this certain number of streets, and the next street, and so on. They were sort of ordering people out. Now, during the deportation, the Germans enlisted the support of Latvian and Ukrainian soldiers. These Latvians and Ukrainians, they were real murderers. Whatever the Germans were, they were that much more, because to them, murder was the play of the day. When they didn't have anyone to shoot, they used to shoot at the lamps, so there were no lamps left afterwards. When somebody looked out of the window, they managed to catch him, they would shoot. Now, I wasn't there during the deportation, but I remember very clearly the eyewitnesses who came back, who came to the glass factory day after day, because they came from different, they said they were from different streets. And people, and they were telling us what was happening. What happened during the deportation is just unspeakable. The way they were killing people at random, the way they were hitting people at random, the way they were selecting families. A human being simply, it was, to be a human being was the worst thing to be. To be a dog would have been a blessing. Now, whilst deportation was taking place, and there were at that stage 24,000 Jews living in the ghetto, because as the Jews were dying, more Jews were coming in, and in the end there were still 24,000 Jews living there. They decided that 20 to 90% of the Jewish population will be deported, and 10% would be left. And within 7 days they cleared the ghetto. 7 days, 24,000 people were dead, to all intents and purposes. Of course, we weren't sure about it, but this is what really eventually happened. People one knew, one grew up with, people who were very close to, family, all went. It was a storm, like if being in a storm, being tossed away, and then everybody falling apart, and then trying to to save oneself than finding out who is still alive. With all the ignominy and with all the atrocities that went with it. About 3 days after, during the, within 3 days of the rotation, the foreman came to me, foreman, and he said to me, "I have a message for you. Don't worry, everything is all right." He didn't say from whom or what, but just that. I also got a parcel of food. Also from this foreman. And this parcel of food came from a friend of mine who was Jewish, but whose parents had Egyptian citizenship. Now, they lived originally in the ghetto, but about 2 months before deportation was going to take place, they were told that they should move out of the ghetto and live outside. And strangely enough, the building adjoining the building, our building. So I was, of course, I felt relief. First of all, that to be told that everything is all right. So I sort of thought, well, I had a feeling that somehow my father managed to fix everything up. And the fact that this friend was alive, that they didn't touch him, he was a very close friend. He originally did not come from my hometown. He came from actually from Lodz, but we became very friendly during the war. And we used to be together most of the time. And I felt a little bit encouraged by it. Of course, then the deportation finished. Now, the last day of the deportation, the transport was incomplete. They still had some room, one or two wagons, which were empty. Now, for the Germans, this was uneconomical. They wouldn't send the transport without filling up with something. Now, the glass factory was near the railway station. You know, a big factory like this had to be built near where the transport was available. That is why, and we were watching every day, we were seeing these transports going. People screaming. And shouting their names, and so we actually saw it as they were passing by. It was no further than from here to down the garden.
A few hundred yards.
The railway was passing. So since we were the nearest there, so Germans came in and were just grabbing people at random, whoever they could grab hold of, and push them. Unfortunately, they got hold of me. Somebody came up, kicked me, and said, "Off you go." And I turned around and I said, "I'm a Pole." I used to wear this, I had this duality on me always, you know, where I could easily sort of, I used to say I'm a Pole just as like I really was a Pole. And it didn't, and with such conviction that that I obviously must have always persuaded them that I was Polish. And they looked at me, and they let me go. So, unfortunately, they grabbed hold of somebody else. I can't feel guilty for this, because it was a matter of, if it wasn't me, it was somebody else, or somebody else, or somebody else. Nobody knew what it was all about. After about 9 days, we were then ordered to go back to what was now going to be a smaller ghetto. The smaller ghetto consisted of two half streets. There were adjoining buildings, one side of the street, one side of another street. And here, 2,400 of us were going to live. Now, if we did not have enough room before, now we had even, there was a tenth of the room that we had before. Because from now on, people were living, 10 and 12 people in the room. Of course, the women, the majority of the women, were gone. 99% of the children were gone. And those who were left were mainly men, with a small number of boys around my age. If there were 100 or 150, well, not even that. That was a lot. Now, I went back to the small ghetto, not knowing what to expect, who is alive, who of my family there was. I got uncles, aunts. I always heard them talking about plans, how they're going to survive, what they're going to do, and so on. But this was a storm. And now, where was I? I came in. I met the mother of a very, also a close friend of mine. And when she saw me, she absolutely was out beside herself, got hold of me, kissed me, and cuddled me, and said, "Oh, I'm so happy to see you alive. Have you said, where are your parents?" I said, "I don't know." She said, "Have you got a place to go to?" "No, I haven't been allocated, only just come in." She said, "Look, don't worry. You come, you go and stay with us." Her husband was a sanitary policeman. See, the two of them contracted typhoid very early in the day. And because he had typhoid, that made it possible also for him to be a policeman, worker, a sanitary policeman, because it's no good to, all the sanitary policemen, all of them had typhoid, because then they became immune. So my friend, together with his mother and father, they were left behind. So I went and to join him. Well, first of all, I heard that the friend whose parents had Egyptian citizenship were on the last day taken away and sent together with the rest of the transport. And that was really very sad news. You know, after first getting the food from him and knowing that he's alive, now, of course, I had to find out what happened to my parents. Within 2 or 3 days, my uncle came in. He found at the last minute a special job, which were about 60 people were working. And most of my family were there, and that working. But that was together. That was part of a. The flour mill was in it, and a whole sort of. They worked in the food administration. It was not for the Jewish, but for the Germans, and there were about 50 or 60 people working there. And one of my uncles was in charge of that group. That was my mother's brother. So they all came back to the ghetto. There was my uncle, two of my uncles, my mother's brothers, with their wives, and with one was with the son. Then my father's brother came back with his wife and the baby. So they all managed to save themselves. And they told me that they heard something that my mother and my father are alive, they're in hiding, together with my aunt, my mother's younger sister. So, but I still wanted to see them. Anyway, days went by, then two weeks went by, didn't hear anything. And then I decided I will try and see where they are. And I thought I'll go to the first place where I thought that was the first arrangement they made. So I went out to work, and somehow I managed to get away from the group. I took off my band. At that stage I was wearing a band. At that stage I was nearly 13 years old. And I went outside the town. It was about 3 o'clock. It was November. Bleak day, gray skies, cold. And I walked in, knocked at the door, I walked in. And when the Pole saw me, he looked at me and says, "Get out of here!" I said, "Why?" I said, "All I want to know is whether you know where my father is." He says, "Yes, I know where your father is, but you can't stay here." I said, "Well, tell me where he is." He says, "I can't tell you where he is. I can take you there." So I said, "Fine, take me." He says, "No, I won't take you now because it's too dangerous. I'll take you at night." So I said, "Can I hide here?" He says, "No." I said, "Let me hide under the bed." He says, "No, you get out of here. I have a lot of problems. I'm being watched. You must get out of here." What was I to do? So I went and I started walking around to try and kill time. Suddenly, from nowhere, I heard young children shouting, "Jew, Jew." Now, I don't know whether they were playing a game of a Jew, or whether they thought that I am a Jew, or whatever, but when I heard it, I started running. And when I started running, they started chasing me. Well, I thought, this is it. That was the time when really there was not even a question of if somebody was caught. No question about ever getting away with it. It was certain death. Well, I lost them because I knew the place quite well. It was not all that far away where we used to live before the war, and it was on the other end of a most beautiful park. We had the most beautiful park in our town. This was wonderful flowers, and it was really quite something. And I knew that park very well because we used to play hide and seek and so on. So I hid myself there amongst the flowers. And I could hear them running around, looking. This. Anyway, I managed to get away. They left me, they went away. And I didn't know what to do, whether to just lie there until it was dark or what. I said, "No, I'm getting out." Anyway, I went out, started walking. Then I sat down on a bench just outside the park. Then a woman with a young boy sat down at the bench as well. This boy was about, I think, 3 or 4 years younger than I. And they lived in the same building where we lived before the war. And they lived not cellar, but in the basement. They were very poor Poles. But he had an older brother who was always very much on the attack and always trying to hit Jewish people, Jewish boys. So when I saw him, this boy kept on hitting. His mother said, like this, you know.
Pointing
at me, as if, you know, he recognized me. I sort of didn't want to run away. I didn't want to sort of to give myself away. So I sort of sat sitting there, pretending as if I don't. And she kept on saying to him, "No, no, no." Anyway, after about 10 minutes, I thought, "I think I've done enough to prove to them that I was maybe somebody else," and I walked away. Because, you see, unfortunately, at that stage, the Poles were very much cooperating with the Germans, and they were pointing out someone who was Jewish. Here we had simply no chance, because there was nobody really to protect us. You see, the Germans declared that any Jew that will be hidden by Poles, any Jew that is hidden by Poles, will not only the Jew be killed, but so will the Poles be killed. So, I mean, I can understand when the Poles didn't want to give shelter to Jews. After all, their life was in jeopardy as well.